So I just wanted to start out by asking you, this will be the first time that you will have played in Bloomington in a while, won't it?
Yeah, it's been years and years since I played there.
Yeah, I think I first saw you down here, either with DKV Trio or with the Vandermark Five. There was a collective here in town called Beyond the Pale.
That correct.
Used to bring you guys here quite a lot back in the late 90s and the early aughts. So, it's great that you're coming through town again. And have you been playing much around the Midwest in the last few years other than not being in Bloomington?
Yeah, I mean, most of the work has been connected to concerts in Chicago and Milwaukee, and recently more in Madison. But I'm hoping to extend the loop in the Midwest for concerts for my work more and more over the next couple years. I mean, most of my concerts have been happening in Europe in the last decade. And in the last 3 years, I've been able to do more work in the States, which is really exciting. And just recently, I mean, I got home, I think 2 days ago or a day ago, I can't remember now. Monday I got home anyway, from a tour with a new band called Marker, which is based in Chicago. And it would be great to get down to Bloomington with that band, hopefully this year.
Phil Sutterberg is a member of Marker, is he not?
That's correct. Yeah, Phil's in that band.
Right, and he'll be playing with you at the Back Door here in Bloomington. I wanted to ask you, you grew up in an era, I think you and I are actually about the same age, you grew up in an era, 1980s, came a musical age in the 1980s, when many younger jazz musicians were embracing a kind of more of a neoclassic approach to the music. And I want to ask, what pulled you more in the direction of free or outside jazz?
Well, I was fortunate to grow up in the Boston area at a time when there were a lot of really innovative musicians playing. We got to see Joe Morris perform all the time, and he's a major figure in the new music. He's an amazing guitarist and improviser and a teacher at New England Conservatory of Music now as well. So he's a really important educator. And also saw a group called Shock Exchange very often that featured Dave Bryan on keyboards, and he was part of Ornette Coleman's Prime Time group. So I was seeing very important people that were based in Boston, but also lots and lots of musicians coming through from New York and sometimes from Europe. I saw Peter Kowald in Boston, for example. And it was an amazing time for music there, you know, getting to see people like Don Cherry and Ed Blackwell play duo two nights in a small club. Those kinds of things resonated with me. And at the same time, getting more and more curious about the new music that I was hearing, like from Joe McPhee, for example, getting to see him play, getting to see Peter Brotzman play. And I grew up in a family where jazz is being played on the stereo all day long. And my father's interest in the music started moving more outside the mainstream as I got older. And so basically, I got exposed to all this stuff as a teenager live, which was the reason it connected with me so strongly. And very quickly, I realized that's the way I wanted to go. There was so much freedom in the music. There were so many possibilities and approaches to the music. And as I got older, that thread of activity became much more interesting to me than the mainstream of jazz and the neoconservative movement you're talking about in the 80s with, maybe best known to the work of Wynton Marsalis, became less and less interesting to me.
What led to you moving to you were talking about growing up in Boston, and people now really associate you with Chicago because you've lived there for quite a while now, and a lot of your musical activities have been based there. What led to you moving to Chicago in 1989, and why did you end up deciding to stay there?
That's a really good question. I mean, there were factors in Boston that made me want to leave. My family's based there, and I go back there all the time. But there's sometimes, I don't know how you put it, a place, either you connect to it or you reject it. And at some point, I just had trouble being in the city. There are a lot of amazing musicians there, people I still keep in touch with and work with, such as Kurt Newton, who I started playing with in the mid-80s in Boston. I just played with him this summer in Chicago, an amazing drummer. So I still have a lot of ties to that area and that city. But in 1989, I was like, okay, I think I know what I can find here, and I need to go someplace else. And because I didn't like Boston, I naively thought that going to New York would be a more intense version of what I didn't like about the attitudes I found in Boston. And in retrospect, I would have been very wrong about that. you know, New York and now the Brooklyn activities and the activities in Queens. That whole scene is way, way different, and the city itself has a way different attitude and, I don't know, social environment than I guessed at from seeing it from Boston at that time. And the other cities that had vibrant scenes in the mid-'80s or the end of the 80s were Chicago and San Francisco and the Oakland area. There was an amazing scene going on in that at that time. Before the whole dot-com stuff blew up and the rents got out of control and kind of decimated that scene in many ways. And I had friends in Chicago from university when I went to school at McGill in Montreal. And so I visited Chicago a few times to see them, and the amount of music happening in the city compared to Boston was like 10 to 1. I mean, the concert listings pages in the weekly arts review, I mean, there were so many clubs and so many different kinds of music happening. I just said, I got to come here and at least spend a year, because even if it doesn't work out, I'm going to be able to see all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's so many different things happening in Chicago culturally too, outside the music, that are super exciting. So I came here, and the first 2 years were extremely, extremely difficult for me. I initially started playing almost right away with the Hal Russell Energy Ensemble, and that was amazing. And for a few months, you know, I was performing with them in Chicago and outside Chicago, and they got invited to play the Moores Jazz Festival. And coinciding with that, Mars Williams decided to rejoin the band. I was kind of filling in for him in a small gap of time. And they rehired Mars and asked me to leave, which was a really crushing blow to my ego. Thankfully, history has a way of working itself out, and I'm really good friends with all the members of that band. And after Hal Russell passed away, Mars asked me to join the Energy Ensemble as it continued after Hal left the planet, let's say. So a lot of things worked out in a kind of extraordinary way, but at the time it was really, really difficult for me. And then I went through a period of almost 2 years where I couldn't find people to work with who were like-minded. I tried playing with lots of different people, and some things would start going well, and then they would fall apart for different reasons. And so for 2 years, I basically practiced and wrote tunes in the basement of the apartment that I was living in. And in January of 1992, Ken Kessler, who was in the Energy Ensemble, contacted me about trying to work on a project. He had a quartet he was trying to start with, or I should say a group he was trying to start with, Michael Zarang. And they had a guitarist named Chris DiChiara at that point. They wanted to see if I wanted to do something. So I showed up to the rehearsal with this like, stack of tunes that I had been writing for the 2 years previous. And they were like, holy crap. They were like kind of in shock. You know, I was like so raring to play. Yeah. And that coincided with all these other things that you didn't have any control over. I mean, Michael worked at a place called Hot House. And they asked him if he had a group that could play there on Tuesday nights because nothing was happening. And I was like, let's do it. And Kent was like, that's crazy. I played once a month with Hal Russell and no one came because we were playing too much. And I was like, oh, we got to do it. And we started in the first, you know, 4 months. It was really light. But then at that time where the club was based, which was Wicker Park, all the artists and musicians, or many of them, were based in that area, and they started coming to our shows. And a lot of those people were rock musicians, and that kind of opened up parts of that scene for me, and that's how I met Jim O'Rourke and, you know, a whole set of contacts and collaborators that I still work with now. And simultaneously, like almost a couple months later, I went to Champaign-Urbana because Anthony Braxton was giving lectures, and I just went down there. And my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, Ellen Major, she said, "Man, you got to bring a tape," because I, you know, recorded a couple things. And I'm like, "I'm not going to bring a tape down to play for Anthony Braxton because there's not going to be even a situation for that anyway, because I don't go to the school, you know." And she's like, just do it. And she went down with me, and I brought a cassette of a performance I had done with a trio that didn't work out, but we had a recording of it. And the first day he did this amazing lecture and overview of jazz history that was extraordinary. And the next day he was doing master classes. And I thought I'd try to sneak in. even though I didn't go to the school, and which is pretty brazen. I don't know, like, if I would have the gumption to do that now, but, you know, I was like 26 or sure, whatever, yeah. 7. So I went to where the master classes were, and by chance, Braxton was in the hallway. He's like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm here to come to one of the sign up for the master classes. Just come in. We're all, he's got such a great voice. We're all in the room together. I don't do single meetings. You know, we want to pool the information. And so he just dragged me basically into this office that was packed with, I don't know, about 20 musicians that, you know, all just piled in on top of each other. And they're all looking at me because they don't recognize me because I didn't go to the school. And they were all, you know, I don't know, getting master's degrees or, you know, PhDs in performance or something. I don't know what. And he said, oh, what do you got for us? And what's your name? I said, oh, it's Ken Vandermark. He said, okay, Mr. Vandermark, what do you have for us? And I had this cassette that Ellen had told me to bring. And I said, well, I got a cassette. Okay, let's listen to it. So I basically stumbled into this masterclass situation, and within 30 seconds he had put this cassette into the stereo and listened to the whole piece, which was about, I don't know, 7 minutes long. And I've never had a panic attack before, but I had one. I mean, my heart was going, I mean, I thought I was going to fall over. And these other people in the room are glaring at me because, like, who is this guy? Why is he getting all this attention? You know, and I'm freaking out because Anthony Braxton is still one of my heroes.
Yeah.
He's listening to my music. You know, it was so overwhelming and so shocking in the speed at which it happened. And he listened to the whole thing and he said, amazing. Absolutely brilliant. Amazing work, Mr. Mark. No licks. All originality. You're a brilliant man. Thank you for sharing this amazing music with us. I really almost passed out. It was one of the most exhilarating moments of my life, you know.
Oh, I'll bet.
And now that I know a little bit more about Braxton, he's that kind of person. Anything creative, he just champions it immediately. But hearing that from my idol, basically, because at that time I was studying his music. I just read Forces of Motion. I had all the quartet recordings of Marilyn Crispell and Jerry Hemingway and Mark Dresser. I mean, I was deep in that music. And for him to look at me and say, your work counts, I was like, man, I'm staying in Chicago. I'm going to work with the Vandermark Quartet, and I'm right. Like, he really made me feel like I was right, you know?
Total
validation.
Yeah, what better kind of validation could you ask for?
Oh, it was, I mean, it was impossible that happened, but it really did. And so I stayed. And then that's kind of how everything shifted.
Did you ever, before that happened, during these kind of early years when you were, you know, kind of struggling to get your music out there and everything, were there alternative paths that you considered that would have not been a jazz or musician-related path?
No. When I was in college, I got a liberal arts degree and a film and communications major. I love film, and I still do, and that's my other big passion as far as, like, following things. But as I stayed in school, I became more and more and more serious about music. You know, I'd gone through public schools that still had music programs, and I was playing the saxophone already. And when I went to college, I put a band together, and we were playing concerts. And I just started getting more serious about music and less interested in everything else, and kind of squeaked by in getting a degree even. But I did graduate, and when I came back, I mean, when I went to Boston, it was like, I want to play my music. I want to play original music, and just work day jobs for years. I mean, I got out in 86, and basically from 86 to 96, I worked full-time day jobs. You know, I worked at a 7-Eleven for years in Boston in a hardware store, and then came to Chicago and actually worked at the 7-Eleven just outside Wrigley Field for a while.
Wow.
And then ended up working at the Art Institute of Chicago because I scored really high on a math test, so they put me in, and I worked at the retail shop for a while, and ended up in marketing of the accounting department doing paperwork for them. So I did that for years and ended up over at the School of the Art Institute working at the video data bank doing similar, you know, bill paying jobs and whatnot. And then the music got more active, and I was touring more and basically was phased out my day job working, you know, was doing like a part-time job for years and then phased that out. And, you know, I owe more than I can really say to Ellen, because she supported me through all of this, and she's a pediatrician. And so the combination of working more in the music and getting more concerts and generating some more income that way, and her, like, complete support of me, I was able to phase out the day jobs and just work harder and harder on the music. And a lot of the people I work with, not just in the States, but also in Europe, aren't able to, you know, pay their rent, so to speak, through just the music. They have other jobs. And I'm fortunate enough to be in a position where I can devote myself full time to music and creating, you know, possibilities in programming music, you know, let's say the Option Series in Chicago now, or putting tours together. And I take that very seriously. Like, I have a very fortunate situation at home, and I work hard because of that freedom that Ellen has really helped afford me.
Well, you, I know you also, in 1999, got a MacArthur Foundation grant, and I wanted to ask how that changed your life and what it enabled you to do that you hadn't been able to do previously, artistically speaking.
Well, without question, the MacArthur Prize was a game changer for me in many ways. And the primary thing it did is it gave me for 5 years economic resources that made a bunch of projects possible that never would have occurred. My approach to playing and my approach to working with people has remained consistent, you know, from before that time to after the funds were gone. But in those 5 years, it really helped me bring a bunch of music to the States that I was excited about, primarily through working with Peter Broetzman, the Chicago Tintet. There were two very big tours that took place in the States that were funded by the MacArthur Prize. A lot of the bands I was working with that were based in the U.S., but primarily the Vandermark Five, those tours were funded. I brought other groups. There was the Territory Band that was half European and half Chicago-based, and we did work here in Chicago on a bunch of recordings that was all funded by the MacArthur. So those projects accelerated my development as a musician and as a composer in a way that would have occurred, but instead of 5 years of time, would have maybe taken a dozen years of time. And then the experiences that I had, you know, tour managing the Tintet, you know, in a bus and flying around the West Coast and stuff and into Canada. I mean, all those experiences went back into all the other work I've done since then. So I had, like, you know, an incredible education on creative levels and on practical levels through the MacArthur funds, and all that stuff I think would have taken place, but over a much, much longer period of time. And so I learned a lot in 5 years because of that.
You know, you pretty much many other modern jazz artists today have employed a real kind of, you know, DIY approach, a do-it-yourself approach that's been, you know, really born out of necessity and means a lot more work. But I wanted to ask you, what are the benefits of employing the DIY approach?
Very simply, artistic freedom. I mean, I'm in a field that a lot of people look at as being on the periphery of mainstream society, and in some ways it is. But I feel very strongly that creative work in whatever field is essential to human beings, frankly, you know. And the thing that I have through the way that I work that is priceless to me is that I can do what I want the way I want to within whatever limits I'm faced with economically. So there's lots of things I'd really like to do now. I'd really, really love to have a large ensemble that worked regularly, and I'm trying to figure out how to do that. But working on independent music labels and now having my own record label, I've always been able to put out the records I wanted the way I wanted to. Which is really important because the documentation of my work that exists truly represents my ideas, the good ones and the bad ones, what I was thinking about in 97 and what I was thinking about in 2017. All of that stuff is documented. And for me, as a person who's a huge fan of the music, you know, to pick randomly, I wish there were a lot more recordings by Herbie Nichols. I think there's like 3 or 4 records total. He's one of the great composers in jazz history, and there is not one recording with him with a horn player. And he worked with bands with Roswell Rudd and other horn players. We have no documentation of the way he would comp on piano behind a horn player. Not one, you know. And so I think about that kind of stuff, and I say, okay, you know, these different projects I work with, I get criticism for recording a lot of making a lot of albums. But basically, if you look at the work all of what I'm doing is running in parallel instead of a linear set of developments. So if you look at Miles Davis and his development from when he played with Charlie Parker until he retired in the mid-70s with the Electric Groups, there's an evolution that works in steps by steps by steps. The way I work and a lot of the people I collaborate work is all of these things are simultaneous. So some of the groups I work with are completely free improvising ensembles. Some of them incorporate lots of rock music elements or funk elements, like, let's say, Marker. Some of them are more new music based. And all of this stuff is happening in parallel. And the projects that survive and continue that are most exciting for me, once a year or once every year and a half, like a band like Made to Break, I think has 6 records out now or so. Every year and a half, that group releases a new record. And in that time frame, a year and a half, a lot happens for that band. And the ideas and development of that particular group go through a series of evolutions that I want to document. So if you listen to the first record by that band and the record that came out in November by that group, you're going to hear a bunch of developments individually and as an ensemble that there's now a record of that wouldn't exist if we put out one record. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I take all that stuff really seriously, and I feel that the freedom that doing it myself, so to speak, affords me is priceless. I haven't compromised my work to please somebody else ever. You know, and that's very important to me because that's what I've got. I've got that freedom. And the money, well, we'll figure that out, you know, and making this music sustainable. I mean, I just did a tour, as I mentioned, with Marker, and we do the stuff very bare bones. You know, we got a good deal on the van. We doubled up in motel rooms. We got the, you know, best things we could get with the money that was there. But at the end of that tour, you know, people, let's say we're out for a week playing every night, everybody in the band got $400. And I didn't pay myself in order to at least pay them that much. Now, for me, it's an investment in the future. And so I see in the long term, you know, doing more work with that band, getting better paid gigs for that band, going to Europe with that band, that's priceless to me. And it's worth coming home with no fee for me personally, but at least trying to get something to the other members, which is a ridiculously low amount of money. That's less, I mean, that's like $50 a show per person, which is insulting, frankly. But that's the reality we're dealing with. And if we see it as a future endeavor that we're developing now, those are the kinds of sacrifices the people I work with are willing to make because there's a bigger picture involved. And part of that picture is doing what we want to do the way we want to do it. So we make economic compromises, you know, to not dumb down the music, so to speak, to make it more populist. We make the challenging music we want. We make huge demands on the audience. And it pays off beautifully in the results, the excitement of playing the music, the excitement that you feel coming back from the audiences. We had incredible crowds all through the tour. And we saw parts of the country I've never been to before. So all that stuff is going to feed me creatively going forward. And there's no price tag on that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you're saying a lot of things that are kind of leading into questions I already kind of had sketched out to ask you today. I wanted to ask you about the word jazz and that term jazz and how it seems to me like some more commercially minded artists have kind of pushed away from it in recent years, as have more avant-garde minded musicians, like maybe some of the folks that you play with a lot. I want to ask, why is that, and how would you define the term of jazz in 2018?
I think that's a really good question. It's one that, it's funny, it comes up connected to jazz history in ways that don't really occur in other forms of music. You know, I mean, very rarely when I'm hanging out with musicians who work in indie rock or like underground rock, let's say, you know, non-commercial rock music, so to speak, they never talk about, well, you know, is it really rock music? There's like this umbrella term rock, which sort of puts things into a category. But then when you look at all the different kinds of, you know, Marky Smith passed away recently. If you look at the music of the Fall and the music of Husker Du and the music of the Minutemen and, let's say, Talking Heads, you know, you're talking about very different kinds of music there,
right?
But it falls under this umbrella of rock music, and everyone kind of knows what you're talking about. No one says, well, is the Fall really rock music because it doesn't follow an AABA kind of form or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, but with jazz, this always comes up. It always comes up as a conversation. Is it really jazz? And I think that goes back probably to this Downbeat article in the, I guess, very early 60s, where there was someone criticizing John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy's work that they were doing together as anti-jazz.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? And I think that set something in motion that we haven't recovered from. And there's like so many factors going on connected to the real history of jazz, which is totally connected to issues of race in this country, into issues of ownership and authenticity. And these are very complicated issues that have never been resolved as a country yet, never mind in terms of the music. So I think, you know, if you talk, you look at people like Duke Ellington or Charles Mingus, who normally are associated with the history of jazz as among the greatest people in the field, often and almost always it was like Mingus music. He called it Mingus music, and Ellington called his, you know, his music Ellington, you know, Ellington's music. He didn't call it jazz. They define it through their own terms, you know, even though they were considered jazz artists. So my relationship to jazz is one has been always of admiration, because I grew up listening to that music and seeing it live as a kid. As a, you know, I started going to shows when I was like 5, and these people playing this music, all of them were heroes to me. Amazing, amazing, exciting people to see. I mean, I saw Art Blakey play with the Jazz Messengers, I don't know, 30 times. And I get to go backstage with my dad because I was a kid, and he always was gracious and excited. Wow, you play music? What do you play? You know, I mean, and it was like, this is Art Blakey, you know?
Yeah.
He's saying hi. You know? So I have, through that and through the music, as I learn more about it, the history of jazz, the real history of individuals and innovation, of people being unique, like Thelonious Monk, like Duke Ellington, like Charlie Parker, you know, like Mary Lou Williams. I mean, this history is super vibrant and exciting, and it didn't stop. It just shifted and developed, like all real art forms. So, you know, all these things that happened in the 70s, which I think is one of the greatest periods in the music, it became very complex because there were all these incredible developments, like let's say with the AACM in the United States, just to pick one example, the Black Artist Group in St. Louis, to pick another example. But also things went to Europe and Japan in that period, and these amazing developments happened overseas that for me are connected to jazz history, like the work in England with Evan Parker, Derek Bailey, or the FMT artists, you know, like Peter Boatswain and Alexander von Schlippenbach, and you know, the Yamashita Trio in Tokyo and in Japan. So the music spread all over in very unique individual ways that use the methodologies, as I see them, of creating jazz music and applied it to different backgrounds. Yes, there were musicians in Europe playing jazz music stylistically, and some of them were great, like Lars Gulin, an amazing baritone player based in Sweden. But the music that they were playing was definitely derived from and deeply developed and influenced by the music happening in the United States by Black American artists who were the innovators and really the creators of this incredible kind of music making. And, you know, in the 70s, there were more and more white artists became involved, more European artists became involved that had their own stylistic interests, or aesthetic interests. I should use the word aesthetic. It's a better word. And that makes the picture much more complicated. So for me, I associate Derek Bailey with jazz, not because his music sounds like Kenny Burrell, but because it doesn't sound like Kenny Burrell.
Right.
Because he pushed against that paradigm and found a whole new way to play the guitar, a whole new way to improvise. Now, I think if Derek Bailey was alive, he would totally reject my proposition on this and say, I'm not a jazz musician. I never, you know, I moved away from that music. But the irony is one of the last records he made was a record of his interpretation of jazz standards called Standards, which kind of says a lot about my point. So even if you're using a dialectic approach to the source material, you're still connected to that material. So to me, jazz has evolved and shifted into a whole different set of aesthetics that still are about improvisation as being a primary concern, still about incorporating different kinds of music back forms, different ideas, like Miles Davis and Duke Ellington are great examples, the work that Duke Ellington did with Billy Strayhorn, as they traveled around the world incorporating all these different kinds of music that they heard. Miles Davis's interest in electric-derived music, rock music, and funk that led to his groups in the 70s. They're taking in new ideas and putting them through a process of improvisation that's derived from methodologies developed by African-American artists, and putting them in a whole new spectrum of activity. And I think that's continued to now. So in 2018, it's very difficult for me to use the term jazz, like I'm a jazz musician, because what I play for most people doesn't sound like their archetype, which is basically the Lincoln Center archetype for the music. And because of all the codification that has happened in conjunction with the branding and marketing of that kind of jazz, I am totally opposed to that codification process. So I can't use the term jazz anymore because they have a multi-million dollar marketing campaign that's defined it between these very limited parameters, to be frank. And so if I use that term, immediately people think of the Lincoln Center and what Whit Marcellus has been doing, and that approach to a neoconservative mainstream that I have nothing to do with. So speaking personally, and of course I can only speak for myself, for all these reasons, what I do can't be considered jazz any longer, and I'm very frustrated by that because I think the music is alive and well. It's in the underground, as it really has always been, to be honest. All the innovative stuff, and bebop was rejected when it came out by jazz fans. That evolution hasn't stopped. The innovation hasn't stopped. It's just gone into ways where the idea of anti-jazz that was established by Downbeat, you know, in the 60s, still haunts the music in a way that you're either for us or against us. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And anytime you've got that mentality going, you're for us or against us, which we're seeing in the White House right now, is very dangerous.
Well, yes.
And on the level of creativity for the world I live in, for or against, there's no room for that because that's not the way art works. And politics shouldn't work that way either. So I feel the work that I'm doing, the work that my the people I collaborate with, is very important politically, not because the music we're making is didactic, but like all individualistic artists, by being individual in a time where being individual is challenging to the status quo, it gives another option for people to say, hey, I can be who I am. Not for or against, but with other people who are who they are. So this is a very important time to be doing this work. And so even though people will say, you're an experimental musician, you're an improvising musician, no one listens to what you do, you're on the outside, I feel what I'm doing is very directly on the inside at the root of what needs to be happening now, as all the artists that are working right now are doing all over the world, because we're in a political crisis of conservatism happening globally right now. And the more people that do their own thing and do it their own way, DIY, the better we're going to be off for it, because there's going to be more ideas happening together and not against the paradigm, but finding a new way to do things. And so finding new ways to do things through the music is also a way to find new things to do as a human being. And that's what we need right now.
You're really kind of anticipating some of my questions because you just kind of answered what was going to be the last question I was going to throw your way. But what you're saying too kind of ties into the next question I had on my kind of sketched out list here, which kind of goes back to the 60s and jazz history because you're coming here as part of the Wounded Galaxies Festival paying tribute to the year of 1968. And I wanted to ask you what the significance of that year is in jazz history and how it might still resonate today. I mean, I know there are certain albums that came out that year, like Peter Brotzman's Machine Gun and Anthony Braxton's three compositions of new jazz. But how does that year resonate for you in jazz history?
Well, I think what you just said is the ideal way to express it. I mean, the fact that Machine Gun came out in Europe with a bunch of European musicians on that, you know, Han Bennick's on that, who is Dutch. You've got, you know, Peter is German, just to use those examples. The fact that so close after World War II, you could have people from countries that were blowing each other to bits, working together and making something as a statement against the political paradigm that was happening, because Machine Gun is very distinctly that. It's a very political record from the cover to the contents on that record. And Peter talks about it that way when he is willing to talk about that recording. It says a lot about the power of the arts to me. You know, the 1968 was a highly volatile time, lots of demonstrations in the United States, in Europe, lots of younger people coming forward to propose new ways to do things because the paradigm was rotting to the core. And there's something very beautiful about an album that's so angry in so many ways that just by the nature of its existence shows that people can work together and make change together despite the history that was just around the corner for them. I mean, Han Bennick's mother was pregnant with either Han or his brother during World War II, and she used to hide explosives under her clothes because she knew the Germans wouldn't search her because she was a pregnant woman.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Han Bennick then, as a 20-year-old, or, you know, it's whatever age, I'm not good with ages, but Han and Peter, in their 20s, were working together that soon after the intensity of animosity going on and destruction that went on. That's the power of the arts. They worked together because of the music and what they believed in and what the music could do as a force. And the same thing's true with the AACM. The politicized nature of that work was extremely important. And I think we need that right now. And I don't like didactic music. In general, it's really the worst platform for political ideas. You know, the idea that this music says I'm angry is so simplistic, it reduces all the complexity involved in the times we're living in. But I do believe the arts and the power of the arts, as indicated by the work of the AACM, as indicated by the work of recordings made on FMP, as indicated by the history of the year you're talking about, the arts were a focus in all of those things happening as an expression, another way to release ideas concurrent to what was going on at that time. And I think if you look at 2018, half a century later, and you look at the work that's happening this year from a distance, if we make it that far, you're going to see very similar kinds of activity happening. The frustration that's going on amongst open-minded people around the world is getting more and more extreme. And people are becoming aware they have to participate in the democratic process if it's going to function, even on the surface, as a democracy, whether at home or abroad. And you're going to see activity in the arts, in music, in the visual arts, in film, every art that's going to directly confront these ideas, maybe in ways that are not didactic, but in ways that are true to the experience of this time and what it means to be alive right now. And so 1968 resonates with me just like 2018 resonates with me. Now's the time.
Well,
we have to be active now.
Well, and once again, that kind of leads right into the next question I had for you, which has to do with how Wounded Galaxies is featuring a variety of art forms, film and literature and art, and these are all forms that have inspired you. You mentioned earlier you had degrees in English and cinema, and I wanted to ask how that inspiration is transposed into the music that you create. Like, how does the aesthetic energy of non-musical forms such as books or films or paintings translate into your musical expression?
There's two factors, or primary factors. One is the inspiration I get from the individualism of the artists I admire. Let's say Willem de Kooning is maybe my favorite painter. And the fact that he hadn't sold a painting until he was 40 years old talks a lot about commitment. And now he's considered one of the great painters in history. But he went through some pretty heavy periods before doing that. Then the other part of it, so I like reading biographies of artists just to see what they dealt with and how they came to their ideas. You know, I'm a big fan of Samuel Beckett, and Beckett's early work is highly influenced to detriment, from my perspective, with James Joyce. He worked with James Joyce on Finnegan's Wake. And when Beckett figured out what to do to push against that, you know, it's a little simplistic to say it was the opposite of Joyce's approach to language, but you can definitely see the push to the extreme reduction of essential language in Beckett's work, especially in the plays as they go on. Those kinds of things are informative to me. I really believe in the idea of a dialectic against what's in front of you to find another way to do something, or deconstructing something that exists to find another way to do something, to tear down the model to find another way to do something. And over again, I see the artists I admire in all different kinds of fields doing things like that. The ability to look in a completely new way at something that's always been in front of us, but to actually see it and translate it into a new medium, that's the highest thing possible. That's how you end up with someone like Ornette Coleman. I mean, the way he got to where he got to, there were a lot of musicians wrestling with the idea of trying to find open form, open harmony, and Ornette came up with the best version of it, and that became a new model. You know,
yeah,
it takes a genius to do that. So that's part of it. But also trying to find new ways to create structure as a composer and new kinds of architecture for the music is very fascinating for me personally. And I get most of my influences actually from film, the construction in film, and methodologies developed by different directors I like in film, because it's outside of my field. And if I look at people doing stuff in my field, it's very easy to get sidetracked by the nuts and bolts of music. But when you're really looking at for different ideas about how to construct things, going to another field of endeavor is useful because you can just get rid of all that baggage and look at what's in front of you and apply those ideas directly. So, for example, ideas about editing, ideas about superimposing time, these kinds of things that can come out of cinema, I can recognize those things and say, yeah, I can use this in my music. So filmmaking has been very, very important. There's one of my favorite films is Vivre sa vie by Godard, and the beginning of that film, it starts with the titles superimposed over Anna Karenina's face with a bit of music, a fragment, I think it's Michel Legrand did the score. It's this piano fragment with strings. I think actually it's just strings. Anyway, the point is, it starts off and it's a front shot of her, and then it cuts to the side of her face, and it starts over again with the music. Seems to be the same action. And then it goes to the third shot from the other side. You think, okay, I've seen this. But then when you really look, you realize every shot was different. It wasn't the shot from three different angles done in sequence. They look like the same shot. It feels like it's the same thing. But when you really look, you realize you're not looking at what's really in front of you. And that whole film is constructed with that methodology. And when I saw that, I was like, I want to do that in music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And how do I go about doing that? And then that opens up a bunch of strategies that I can apply to my music, and that's where I get those sources from.
What kind of strategy will you and Phil Sutterberg be using when you perform at the back door? Like, how do you generally approach a performance, a live performance? I know, obviously, certain configurations might require different strategies. You'll be playing in a duo at the back door. Sometimes you're playing in much larger ensembles. But what do you usually do before a performance to kind of get yourself in the zone for it?
Well, I'm really looking forward to the concert with Phil tomorrow because we just got off a tour with the band Marker, and that group deals with my compositions. And I've only worked with Phil in a completely improvised context once during a recording session with Matt Skusason and Tim Daisy that took place early this past fall. So for me to go from working with Phil and my pieces to going to like an open field where there's nothing scripted ahead of time is super exciting because I know that the work that we've done in Marker is going to inform what happens at the concert, but it's not going to define what happens at the concert. And generally speaking, when I'm doing a free improvised performance, I try not to have any preconception if possible and just discover what's happening there. Everybody that I play with, both in the States and Europe, when we're doing free improvised concerts, no one talks about anything before the show about the music. It's kind of like, let's discover what's there. And definitely that music is informed by the history of a particular group. It's an ongoing ensemble like Lean Left with Terry Hessels and Andy Moore and Paul Nelson Love. We've done a bunch of work together. So when we go on stage, we have a bunch of history that we push against or consider, but that's done individually, not as a group. Let's not do this. Let's do this. We never have that discussion. Afterwards, we may talk about something if it falls apart, like, you know, some issues that weren't working we may discuss, but we try not to define the music ahead of time in any way to let it be as open as possible. So in a sense, the strategy is not to have a strategy. It's to not try to define the music before it starts and then to really have the discussion on stage, a musical conversation that can be whatever it is and deal with whatever musical subjects we want to explore at that time. So that's kind of the way I'm approaching it. And because Phil and I have been working together now for a year and a half, we do have a lot of history together, just not in this particular method of making music that's totally improvised. So I'm really excited to see what happens with it.
Well, I know you keep up a really incredibly busy schedule of performing and recording and in a large variety of groups and contexts. And I wanted to ask if you ever allow yourself any or much downtime at all. And if you do have that kind of time, how do you tend to use it?
I think we'll need to ask Ellen about this and see what she says. I mean, you know, to be honest, like the travel stuff is essential for me on a creative basis and on an economic basis. If I stayed in Chicago, I wouldn't be able to contribute to the economy at home in any significant way whatsoever. So I have to go on the road to make enough money to help support things at home. But a key factor is really that the music is about performing live, is about developing ideas in the context of the process, and the process happens on stage. You can rehearse all you want, and you find out things in rehearsal, but it's testing the ideas out in front of an audience where things really develop. And so from a creative standpoint, I've got to do that on stage with a group. So I'm gone about half a year, scattered throughout the year. You know, I leave on the 20th to go to Europe for a month to do a bunch of different projects over there, and I come home for a month, and then I go out again for a month. So I'm bouncing back and forth. And when I get back home, you know, I really hope for downtime, but basically there are too many projects that need to be put in motion logistically. Like I'm already planning 2019, and there are tours that are happening that I've got to deal with coming up, you know, just in terms of like travel details, in terms of composing music. There's a large group project that has to happen in March. I've got to write the music for that while I'm home now before I leave on the 20th. So, I mean, there's the time in Chicago is extremely busy getting ready to do the next trip or taking in information, which will hopefully help me write new and different music. I guess it's research time, so to speak. So I don't really get a lot of downtime. And aside from just the physical wear and tear that's taking on me now that I'm in my early 50s, you know, that's definitely a factor. And I got to be aware of that. But the real problem is I don't get enough time to consider what's been done. Mm-hmm. And that's from a creative standpoint, that's an issue. Because I just came off the road working with Marker. We're playing these pieces. They're developing in a great way. We have a concert, CD release concert on Sunday in Chicago. And rather than having the time to spend a week to think about, okay, what do we do? What can I do for the next batch of compositions to really move the band forward in a great and interesting way? I've got to focus on writing music that needs to take place in March. And Marker won't be doing anything until the summer. So I lose this period to really consider what's happening. And it's always this kind of rush of activity. And the time to contemplate would be very, very useful for me. And unfortunately, because of the necessities of my life, the traveling and the planning that needs to happen when I get back home, I'm not afforded this time to consider what I've done, to think about what I want to do next. And that's a problem.
I just kind of wanted to wrap up by asking one last question about what people should do, people who support what you're doing, who support the arts in general, who support music and jazz and improvisation artists. The music economy of 2018 is obviously very different than it was even just a few years ago. And, you know, a lot of musicians have really – it was not like it was ever, you know, lucrative and people were rolling in riches or anything like that, but it's become even more challenging to sustain oneself economically as a musical artist. What should people who enjoy your music – what's the best way to support what you're doing in a way that helps you sustain what you're doing?
Well, I mean, to be blunt, we need economic resources to continue to make the music. You know, and that's not just in terms of touring, but it's in terms of making records, documenting things. And the best thing people can do is to go to concerts, see the music live, support the music live, and buy the recordings. I mean, like I said, I just did this tour with Marker, and it was very successful, not just from a creative standpoint. We had great audiences. When I would go out on tour in the 90s, the merchandise, the records sold on the tour, would always match the fees that we were getting. And the case now is that the fees that we're able to get, whether it's a guarantee or a door gig that does well, the records sold are one-fifth that
wow.
money.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. That's kind of why I ask, because I know people that use things like they either use official streaming services like Spotify, which most jazz musicians I've talked to are very unhappy with the total or almost total lack of compensation from that, or people have just gotten used to this idea that music can be accessed for free. And I've kind of been trying to encourage people as much as I can to say you really need to still, whether you're listening via download or CD or vinyl, how important it is, from my perspective, to actually buy the music of the artists that you support.
This is very true, and it's a thing that when you look at the paradigm we're in, and you're talking to someone who's younger than 20, and that they look at what's available for free, the shareware, the software, the streaming on YouTube of great films, for example, all this stuff is essentially free if you have internet access and a computer or a phone, smartphone. It's very hard to say to someone like that, if you don't pay for music, it's going to crush the people making it, you know, because they're getting all this other stuff for free. In addition, the major labels have created a situation with like no support from fans, and deservedly so, because they totally stiffed fans on the CD market. I mean, they were charging, what, $17.99 list for CDs? And the production cost on that stuff, especially on reissues, was like at most a dollar a unit, at most. So they were greedy. And so you don't get this support from the audiences for the artists because the audiences are frustrated with the labels, and that's a fair complaint. You know, it's ridiculous what they did. So the musicians are in a position where their resources are highly limited, you know. And like I said, like, it's a big change, you know. I was only able to pay the musicians a marker $400, whereas if we had made the same amount of money on merch sales as in the mid-90s when I went out, that would have meant that everyone would have been paid fairly. All the costs, the overhead of renting the van, the gas, the rooms, the food, everything would have been paid for through the merch sales. And then all the fees would go to the musicians,
right,
which was a system that was sustainable. Now, when you bring up the idea of Spotify, there's a really interesting thing that a rap artist, Nipsey Hussle, put up on I think, like, mid-January. Now, he's way more successful than anybody that I work with, okay? And he put up a tweet with just the facts of his income from Spotify for 1 million streams, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he got $4,370
oh,
from Spotify for 1 million streams.
Right.
So that system doesn't work. Now, Spotify has an office in downtown Manhattan, I think in the World Trade Center, and they're spending $2.5 million a month on rent for that office. They pay all the people working directly for Spotify very, very, very well. But do they pay the musicians for the content they're sharing with people? Obviously not. Now, there's no way, you know, in a million years, I would never get a million streams on Spotify or these other formats.
Right.
But clearly, they're not compensating the musicians. So we have to come up now, and it's going to come down to the musicians figuring something out because, you know, it's our survival, really, to continue to do the work. We have to figure out a way that we can be compensated fairly for the work we're doing. And I'm not talking about being greedy. I'm talking about just, like, let's pay our rent through our work, so we can continue to do our work. If you're working a full-time job, you don't have the energy and the creative resources to put into your artwork because you're tired.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You just don't have the hours there to practice. And, you know, people, when they hear the work I'm doing, you know, understandably, they're comparing it to the high-level work of someone like Ornette Coleman or Archie Shepp or the Art Ensemble of Chicago or, you know, Peter Brooksman. You know, I mean, and rightfully so, that work. But if I'm stuck behind a desk or working at 7-Eleven or a hardware store 40 hours a week, how am I supposed to practice enough to maintain that level of quality? Never mind get on the road. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We have to come up with a much better system right now, and a lot of resources have been taken away from the musician. And part of it is the sales of music, whether it's, you know, downloaded, paying for streaming, or buying physical copies of things. Audiences need to know how essential that is for the musicians to continue. And there have to be better situations for getting paid well for touring, you know, and that there's compensation on the road that's fair for the number of people who show up to the gigs, for what it costs to go to the shows. All these things have to be reassessed in a way to make it possible for musicians to continue. And that's going to take the musicians to come up with a way. I mean, you know, I'm not going to – it's the fundamental truth is if all the major artists who sell the most recordings, who get the most streams, all said, we're not making our music available anymore on Spotify until they pay fairly. We're not going to let our music be streamed on Amazon Music unless everyone gets paid fairly. And that's just it. And they don't buckle. Then there might be a change. You know, last year, Spotify's revenues went up, but their payments to the musicians went down.
That's not a good paradigm.
No, it's not. It really isn't. So those things need to change as soon as possible if things are going to improve for the musicians making this music, whatever kind of music. It's the situation is all musicians everywhere globally. We're in a very tight spot right now, and we got to find a solution so we can continue to do the work we want to do and share it with people.
Well,
in a fair way.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for all the work that you've done over the last 20 to 30 years. And I'll be coming to the show tomorrow or tonight, I guess, at the back door. And I'll pay my way in and I'll buy a CD.
Well, please say hello. It's been a fantastic interview. Sorry, the dogs are going crazy.
Oh, that's okay.
but no, it's been a superb interview, David. I really appreciate the questions and the leeway to speak openly with you. And when the interview gets posted, could you send me a link to it? Because I'd really like to share it with people, because I think we got to a lot of interesting topics today.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Thank you so much, Ken, and I will see you at the back door. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, and thanks for your patience getting involved with me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Have a great day. All right, take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Take care, David. Bye-bye.
Bye.